All right, so let's begin. My name is Michelle Belorchi, and I'm an Outreach and Recruitment Specialist at the Institute of International Education, known as IIE, and we administer the program. Today's webinar is focused on the awards to South and Central Asia. So this is a virtual advising session for everyone who's putting an application for this competition that the deadline is in September, or if you're thinking about putting in an application, you have some questions about the awards, or you're stuck on the application. So this is a session that's kind of open-ended to assist you as you proceed through the process of applying. So just a little bit of background on the program. The program has been around for almost 75 years. We'll be celebrating our 75th anniversary next year, so we're very excited about the accomplishments of all of our alumni and the applicants who are considering a Fulbright. We have partnered with 160 countries around the world for the Fulbright program, offering opportunities to students and faculty, independent scholars, professionals from a range of professions and backgrounds to teach, conduct research, or to study. And really the mission of the Fulbright program is to foster mutual understanding between people of the United States and people from around the world, to advance knowledge and research, and ultimately to improve lives around the world. The Fulbright program is the United States government flagship international and cultural exchange program. It is sponsored by the U.S. Department of State. We also receive generous funding from our partner countries around the world, and IIE administers the program. So there are several stakeholders that are involved in making this program possible. Diversity in the program is a key component to the outreach and recruitment strategy that we have, and this statement comes directly from the Department of State. It's something that is very, it's a key priority for the program to have a cohort of Fulbright scholars and grantees that represent U.S. society. And so opportunities are open to people of all backgrounds, national origin, sex, age, religion, geographic location, etc. So everything there on the screen. We really try to have a very inclusive program. And so, again, reaching out to people from all backgrounds is very important to what we do at IIE. In terms of the scope of the program, just to give you an idea of the opportunities available in the U.S. Scholar Program, which is the program we're talking about today, offering awards for U.S. citizens based in the U.S. to conduct research or teach abroad. So every year we offer about 800 spots. So there are about 450 unique award opportunities that offer 800 spots. So that's really how the program works on the U.S. side. And then for visiting scholars, we have about 900 opportunities, 900 visiting scholars come. And then, of course, there's the student side of things as well as the foreign student side. So several Fulbrighters come and go every year. We have a robust alumni cohort as well, alumni network. So once you're part of the Fulbright community, you really are plugged in to the broader alumni community as well. All right, so in terms of eligibility for the program, the baseline eligibility is U.S. citizenship. And then after that, it really depends on the award description, the requirements in the award. Even within a particular country, there might be different requirements based on the particular role or grantee experience. So I'm actually going to hide my webcam so that we can focus on the presentation going forward. If you have had a Fulbright grant in the past, we ask that you wait 2 years from the time that you received your grant to the time that you reapply. So past Fulbrighters are certainly welcome to apply to the program again. All right, so before we go into the questions, I did want to cover some of the basic application components. So the application form online is fairly straightforward. The requirements on the left-hand side are for, regardless of what activity or what profile you have. So you are required to fill out the application form, upload a 3-to-5-page project statement, include your CV, and that also has a page limit of 6 pages or 8 pages if it's a Distinguished Chair Award. We do require 2 letters of recommendation. You'll notice if you've applied in the past, that's down from 3. So this year and going forward, we only require 2 letters of 2 letters of recommendation. So the application components, after the 2 letters of recommendation, we do require a language proficiency if it is stated in the award description. Okay, so it's important to take a look. For South and Central Asia, this particular region, I think only the Central Asian countries might have a preference. I don't believe there's any particular requirement. There isn't a requirement for India or Sri Lanka or Nepal unless you're going into an area to conduct research where knowledge of the local language is necessary. So in those cases, it's important in the project statement to state how you'll conduct the research without knowledge of the local language. After that, an invitation letter, if required, or if you'd like to provide that. So you'll notice in the award description, it will state either a requirement, a preference, whether the letter is optional or if it should not be sought. So in that case, you should not make contact with any potential host if it should not be sought. If it's optional or preferred, we always encourage you to provide that invitation letter. It will certainly enhance your application. And then on the right side, if you are proposing to teach or research, depending on what that is, if it's a combination, you'll need both. You'll need course outlines or syllabi, and there are page limits for that. And then you'll need a 3-page bibliography as well. And we do get a lot of questions about the bibliography. And I want to make note that the bibliography is nothing more than a list of all the relevant publications or works related to what you propose to do. So not just what you've authored or published or created, but kind of the state of the art, so to speak. So we would need to see, think of it as a literature review, but just with titles. It doesn't need to be an annotated bibliography. There's no particular format that we're looking for. Any standard format is accepted, but we do need to see that, and there's a 3-page limit for that. And if you're an artist or an architect, creative writer, journalist, etc., you'll see a list of who is required to submit a portfolio. The portfolio has file size limits and things like that. So all of that guidance is in the application. Okay, so going down, drilling down into the project statement, and I'd like to point out, once I get through the slides, I can show you a great resource where we have a brand new tutorial video of what should be in the project statement. But essentially, this is where you describe what you're proposing to do on your Fulbright. Talk about why it's important. Give us details exactly of what you plan to do. If you're teaching, speak about the specific courses that you're planning to offer and why you're offering those. What is the goal of your research? What is the methods, the methodology, the importance and the impact and benefit for the host country or the host institution? And then additionally, these questions we used to ask you, we used to ask that you provide the answers in the project statement, but to ensure that you do, we've separated them and put them in the application form, and these are the following questions. Why are you interested in Fulbright? Why this particular country? And then speaking to your adaptability and your ability to serve as a cultural ambassador. Again, this is a program that is funded by the U.S. Department of State. It is a public diplomacy program at its core. And so through your teaching and research, we would like to see how you are interested and able to serve as a cultural ambassador. All right, so if we take a look at the award description or the award in the awards catalog, I've just kind of pulled an image. It's very important to, once you've narrowed down on the award, but even while you're searching around, you're only able to submit an application for one award per competition. So you can't apply to India as well as Sri Lanka, for example. You can only apply to one award. Unless that award is a multi-country, then you could do India and Sri Lanka. We do have a South and Central Asia regional research program, but that has its own unique award number. And in any case, we advise you to take a look at the all of the tabs here, because all of the information about that specific award will be spread across the various tabs. So the award details is just all of that information that you need to know. The requirements is about the invitation letter or any language requirement or further details about the applicant profile they seek. The stipend and benefits covers the monthly stipend information as well as any kind of benefits available or research allowances, etc. And then, of course, there's the country overview. An important piece on this is the blue box in the right-hand corner, beginning the application process. If you click on that, that'll take you to probably the most important web page in our on our website. And so that is something that you need to bookmark. So as soon as you click on that blue box, it'll take you to that page. And please do bookmark it, because that page has all of the links, the hyperlinks, the information step-by-step as to what we're looking for in the application, what you need to provide in a project statement if you're teaching, if you're doing research, if you're doing a combination, all that kind of thing. Okay, and again, to see if an invitation is required and what that should look like if you do need it, that award requirements tab will state that. And if there is a contact that they would like to point you in the direction for host affiliation or information or additional questions, that contact will be listed in the award requirements tab. Now, what is the invitation letter that we're looking for? And what does the invitation letter signify in your application? Well, keep in mind that it is a non-binding expression of interest from the host. It does not mean that you are going to get the Fulbright grant. We still have the entire review process that starts after the deadline. But it certainly is a strong indication in your application that, depending on how well written the invitation is and how detailed, that your project is suitable, it's going to be feasible because you have a host, you have a collaborator, you'll be able to arrive in country and immediately start on your grant and being productive. Ideally, it should come from the person that you hope to collaborate with, and it should be on institutional letterhead. Beyond that, we do not have a template. There's no one way that the invitation letter should look. There's not, and we purposely don't provide that information because it's too restrictive. A good invitation letter can look like a lot of different things. The key pieces of information it should have is what you propose, what are you going to be doing there at the host institution, how long will you be there, and what benefit they will have. How interested are they in hosting you? What is something that they're looking forward to, in hosting you? So that kind of positive, that enthusiasm, that positive kind of tone is what we're looking for in the invitation letter. So certainly going beyond the one or two line boilerplate, yes, we welcome Professor so-and-so to affiliate for the semester, that's not really going to get you far. So if you can provide them a little more information and negotiate with them to add more detail, that would serve you well. So now what I'm going to do is take the opportunity to go into the question session and also pull up my the website so that we can kind of navigate and have the application open, etc. So I'm going to go to the website, and now we've got about a little over half an hour to troubleshoot all of your questions. So the first question I have is it an independent scholarship program, or it automatically preserves the seat in the colleges? So I'm not quite sure what this question is. So I think if you could retype your question, I'd be happy to answer it, but I'm not quite sure. Preferred colleges. So just to let you know, if the award description that you're looking at, let's take a look. So we're going to open up South and Central Asia. And if we click on, let's say, this is the largest award in the region, right? So we are, I'm going to make my screen a little kind of zooming in. If we take a look at this award to India, we notice that in under locations, it says affiliations are available throughout India except for the Union Territory of J&K, Jammu and Kashmir. Now, this is the key piece. In addition to university and colleges, affiliations with think tanks, non-governmental organizations, and research centers will be considered. That means all of these institutions are deemed appropriate. There isn't a set list of appropriate institutions that you can only choose from. If you're concerned about making the right choice, the contact at the Fulbright Commission is listed here, and you can reach out to her and ask her for suggestions or cross-check to see if the host that you're interested in would be suitable. But typically, any college, university that is not a for-profit institution, as well as research centers, think tanks, et cetera, those are typically fine for the vast majority of awards, unless otherwise stated in the award description. All right, so we have another question. On the letters of recommendation, is the wisest approach to ask a letter from a supervisor and the second from a colleague? Well, that will really depend on what you plan to do on your Fulbright. If you're planning to teach, we certainly do need a letter from someone who has observed your teaching. So I clicked on that blue box in the corner, and I've landed up here on, this is the page I was telling that all of you should bookmark, because I would say 99.9% of the questions you have will be answered here along these tabs, specifically the application tab. So let's take a look at the guidance for the recommendation letters. So we see that here. Try and make my screen a little larger. So right under the application button, and this is where you go to start the actual application. And if you've applied in the past, but you didn't apply last year, this is a brand new application. We've only been using this system since last year. So regardless of whether you applied last year or 5 years ago, you will need to start a brand new application. All right. Now, in terms of the recommendation letter guidance, I'm going to click on the requirements here. And here we see a full page of information. And this is specifically the area that I'm pointing in the direction, who may serve as a recommender. So there's no particular rule except that the recommendation letter cannot come from the same person who's writing the invitation letter. Other than that, it's up to you. So if you're doing a teaching project and you don't include the recommended supervisor, it just shows that you perhaps didn't have that available or you didn't look at the guidance, but it's not going to disqualify you, right? So really, it's up to you. Who would you like to select to speak about your qualities and ability to serve and carry out the project as a Fulbrighter? So again, take a look at the guidance under recommendations. Let's see, we have another question. All right, we had a question about the project statement slide. So let me see if I can pull that up again. All right. Okay. So if we take a look at the last statement. Okay, how will you adapt your materials to the host cultural? Sorry, there's a typo. So the idea is essentially, if you have a syllabus that has been, you know, that you've been using here in the U.S., how have you tailored that to, you know, teaching in Kazakhstan or teaching in Nepal or teaching in India, right? So we'd like to see how you have made materials and concepts and ideas accessible to a completely different group of students. Or if you're doing teacher training, you know, how are you making these things, you know, kind of how are you translating all of this in the sense of, you know, tailoring it to a unique cohort, a unique group, an audience that's different from the audience that you typically teach back in the U.S. So these are the things that we're looking for. How are you able to adapt, you know, to make things culturally sensitive and relevant, right? Because certainly everything that you do in terms of the classroom, not everything can be translated equally, or transferred, I should say. So that's simply what that means. How are you adapting things for this particular country that you're applying to? So I hope that answers your question. All right. Let's go back to the web page. And pull that up. Okay. Well, let's see what other questions have come in. Okay, it looks like we have someone on the call who perhaps is tuning in from outside of the U.S. and looking to come to the U.S. on a Fulbright. So if you are not a U.S. citizen, all of what I'm speaking to you about might not pertain to you because the application form and the entire process for foreign citizens to apply to the U.S. program is very different. So let me show you where you can find that information because I think the question that I'm seeing here is directed to the opportunity of coming to the U.S. on a Fulbright. So if you are a researcher abroad and you're not a U.S. citizen, you would apply through your U.S. embassy or the Fulbright Commission in that country. And there's more information under programs on our website, which is CIES.org. So there's that. Let's see. All right. We have a question about getting more detailed information and kind of advising sessions. So let me point you in the direction of where you can sign up for an advising session or an office hour. So right now I have the award description open. You can open any award in the catalog. And on the right-hand side, you'll see the program staff information. So my information is right here. That includes my phone number, the office line, the email inbox that I look after, as well as the link to join the office hour. So if you click here, we have office hours that are running every day, Monday through Thursday, until the end of the competition, which is, you know, the deadline is September 15. And each day focuses on a different region or regions. So, for example, tomorrow we have East Asia and the Pacific, as well as Middle East and North Africa. So if the award you're applying to falls into that, you would click on that link. For all of you here who are interested in South and Central Asia, the ones I host are on Tuesday, every Tuesday from 4 to 5 p.m. So you can click here to join an office hour. Or you can write to me in this inbox, and we can determine if you need an advising call. So this is where you would find the information. The email address is southcentralasia@iie.org. Again, it's listed right here on the right side of every award in the region. All right. So let's see. We've got a lot of questions that have come in. A lot of questions relating to the invitation letter. So let me go back and show you where you can find that guidance. Again, I've clicked on that blue button, and I'm here at the application page. And I'm going to scroll down because the invitation might not be required, so it's not going to be listed up here. I have to scroll down, and I'll find it here under Letter of Invitation. And clicking here on About Invitations and Developing Contacts Abroad. This is the page that has all of the information as to what we're looking for and how the letter should be structured in terms of what information. So there's no specific requirement. I want to underscore that. There is no specific requirement or template for the invitation letter unless it's specifically mentioned in the award description. And I don't believe that's true for any of the awards in South and Central Asia. But the letter should include the activities for which you're being invited by the host, the period of time for which you're being invited, and a description of the host's interest in the applicant's project and how it will benefit the host. There needs to be a clear statement on how the host will benefit from having you there. Keep in mind, you are applying in a competition for government funding. You want your project to have that wow factor and really stand out. Why is your project important, and why do you need to be at that host? That's what we hope to see in the letter of invitation, and certainly, of course, in your project statement. But the host should be completely on board and completely supportive in whatever way they can be. There's no financial contribution required from the host for any of the awards in South and Central Asia. And if they'd like to offer you an office space or lab access, anything, any kind of facility access or any kind of, anything that they're willing to offer you, please have them state that in the invitation. I can't underscore enough how, the more details, the more information, it will benefit you during the review process. And yes, if you're planning to do additional talks here and there that they're willing to host, certainly they can speak about that. Right. So that is something that's quite important. All right. So let's take a look again at the question box. And keep in mind, if you have questions that are very specific about post-application issues, if you're on the grant and you have questions about potential scenarios while you're in country, that is not something that I can help you with right now in this webinar. The purpose of this webinar is to address questions in the application phase. So please direct your questions to the email, and I'd be happy to take that up and discuss further. But for the purpose of today's webinar, we are discussing the awards and the application process. So just to be clear on what I can and cannot answer at the moment, and I want to keep the focus since we do have a lot of questions coming in. All right. We have a question about the ratio of research to teaching. That's a great question. Sometimes the award will state what desired ratio they have. So, for example, if I pull up the award to Nepal, there is a teaching and research award to Nepal that clearly mentions, in this case, and it's rare, but it's there, that 80% of the grantee's time will be spent teaching, while 20% can be devoted to research. So that's a situation where the award description clearly states the desired ratio of teaching to research. If it's not stated in the award description, that's definitely something that you can determine on your own, or if you're negotiating with the host, something that you would discuss with them. The same is true for the grant length. So, for example, here we see the award says 5 or 7 months. So we get some questions sometimes, well, who determines whether it should be 5 or 7? Ideally, that would be something that your project, the short answer is you decide that. But, of course, that would probably be in conjunction with the host. Because, for example, in this case, for Nepal, the invitation letter is required. So you should ensure that the host is aware that you're planning for 7 months or 5 months. In the case where the invitation is optional, which is true for India, for example. If we pull that award again, the invitation is optional. You'll see that listed here. But it also keeps gives you the option of a grant length of 4 to 9 months. So again, that's something that's up to you. Do you need 4 months, 5 months, 8 months? What would you need for carrying out your research and getting the teaching done? So that's, again, something that you need to negotiate with the host. In the event that the flex option is available, and the flex option is available, you'll notice here that flex grants have a different duration. They can be 4 to 6 months. And within that, there's more information as to how those multiple visits can be done. So there's a minimum of 1 month, a 1 month visit at the shorter end, and no more than 5 months. So that information in terms of the flex grant parameters is found in the award description. All right. So we have a question about what would be the typical course syllabus or outlines, what will be the typical teaching expectations. So nothing will really be typical across countries. It really depends on the country you're applying to and the specific ratio that you have. Regardless of the teaching to research ratio, you are required to submit 2 to 3 course syllabi. So if we click over here, you can get more information as to what is required there. And that's under the teaching section. If you click here, you'll see syllabi or course outline. So all of this information can be found here, so please consult that. And since there is a page limit, we ask that you remove any of the text. If you're using a syllabus that you've used in the past, ensure that all of the boilerplate language about, attendance policy and plagiarism, that none of that is required. It will take up space. We really want to see week by week what you're teaching, what resources you're using, how you're evaluating students, etc. So that is something that needs to be tailored to the application. We have a question about other funding while on a Fulbright. So that's fine. You're allowed to have more than one source of funding, but we do ask that you provide, if you were selected, you'll be sending back and forth a lot of documents to our team, and we ask that you provide information about the amount that you'll be receiving as well as the source of that funding. So that way we need to be aware, and if required, we might tailor the funding, because if, for example, the external funding that you receive covers the flight tickets, for example, then we wouldn't cover the flight tickets for you. So as long as there's no double dipping, so to speak, you should be fine. All right, so moving along, let's take a look at the next question. Okay, going back to the invitation letter. Again, the invitation letter guidance that we have, as I said, there's no hard and fast rules. The only rule that we have is that the invitation letter cannot come from someone who's also providing a recommendation letter to you. And of course, it should be on institutional letterhead. But if the person who you hope to collaborate with is not able to provide the invitation letter, it's fine if it comes from the department head or the dean. That's fine. We understand some institutions have kind of a, not necessarily a hierarchy, but there's a certain protocol as to who is allowed to furnish the invitation letter. So we just state that ideally it should come from the person that is inviting you or that you'll be collaborating with. But if it comes from somebody else at the institution, that's fine. The key thing is that it needs to include the details about your visit and the importance of your project. Okay, we have a question and an eligibility question about a PhD from a non-academic institution. So if you could actually send us an email specifically stating that, but from my understanding, a PhD is a PhD, and if the host institution is willing to invite you and is fine with your qualifications, keep in mind whenever you reach out to a host institution, you typically would send your CV and kind of an abstract of what you hope to do, especially if you're in a situation where it's kind of a cold calling situation. You haven't reached out to them before. They don't know who you are. So sending your CV as well as the project proposal or the abstract would certainly be helpful. And if they are okay with that, that's fine. But for us, a PhD, any institution that grants a PhD, from our understanding, is an academic institution. So, all right. Let's see. We have several questions that have just come in. All right. Let's take a look. All right. We have a question about the review process. So I'm going to go back to that main page that I told you all to bookmark. And the timeline is right here. So first let me point out the review criteria, because that's kind of uniquely, that is directly tied to the timeline, and you'll understand more in terms of all the stakeholders involved. But essentially, this is the criteria that we give our reviewers. It's kind of the rubric that they need to refer to as they review each application. So looking at the teaching component, the research component, the impact, the personal qualities, et cetera. And then moving over here, you'll see the timeline kind of phase by phase as to how the application goes through the various phases, whether, you know, starting out with the U.S. review and then the in-country review and then the Fulbright Foreign Scholarship Board review. And then the notification phase. So certainly there are eyes on it from multiple places. We have the U.S. review, which takes place first. That's in October and November. That's a discipline review. And then in December all the way up until May, there is the in-country review. And a few countries also have an interview process that they'll probably do over Zoom or Skype, and so that will also be in that time. And then notifications about selection take place from January, typically through April or May, but some can go out as late as June. All right. Moving on, we've got about 20 minutes left, so I think we're going to be able to get to everybody's questions, but feel free to keep chatting them in. All right, it looks like we have a couple students on this call. If you're interested in the ETA program, please refer to the Fulbright student page, which is this page here. So that's a different program. So just to let everybody know, if you have a bachelor's degree but you don't have a PhD, and you're an early kind of career, you're early in your career, you don't have a terminal degree, the Fulbright student program is an option for you. But that's not the focus of the webinar today. So please refer to the guidance here, and there's several webinars geared towards ETA applicants. All right. Let's take a look. Go back. And if you have specific questions about your application last year and for a particular country, please follow up with me in an email, and then we can kind of devote time to that. Again, my email address is here under Program Staff, Michelle Bellocci. That's who you want to contact. It's the South Central Asia email inbox. And again, if you joined late, this session is being recorded, and so you'll find it in our webinar schedule in the archive section. You can also join an office hour. That's here in the bottom corner, that blue button. You can click there to join the office hours. We have every Tuesday from 4 o'clock to 5 o'clock Eastern Time, and that's specific to the South and Central Asia region. If you're looking at other awards in other regions, please refer to those office hours on the other days. All right. We have a question about how to know which projects will be the most valuable to the particular country that you're thinking of. Well, actually, you would probably be the experts in that. Considering that you're the expert in your field, you would probably have a good idea of the other colleagues internationally that you could connect to and find out where they're based, and also take a look at the award descriptions. A lot of the award descriptions do state the priorities of the country, because a lot of these countries are co-funding the opportunities. So if we take a look at the award to Sri Lanka, we see it's open to all disciplines, but here they list the areas of interest: archaeology, commercial agriculture, data sciences, TEFL, entrepreneurship, nursing education. So it's very important to take a look at the areas of interest and also use the keyword search filter, you know, the keyword search here in our catalog, and search for things, you know, your specialization, and pull up those awards that really are looking for people with your profile. That's where you're going to be most competitive. All right, so let's take a look again at some of the questions. All right, so we have someone who is, it looks like perhaps a dual citizen. Can you apply for any other region? So first of all, U.S. citizenship is required, as I mentioned in the beginning. If you hold another citizenship, that's fine, but please check in the award description to see if that country allows dual citizens. So I believe in the South and Central Asia region, there isn't anything like that. But for example, Australia and Germany, Spain, and a couple other countries do not allow their dual citizens to apply for awards in those countries. So if you have an Australian passport, you're not allowed, you're not eligible to apply for awards to Australia, for example. So take a look at that. I hope I answered your question, because it looks like you might be based in India, so I'm not sure if that is something that makes sense. Let's take a look again at the questions coming in. If my research project requires approximately 4 months, can the invitation be for 5 months, which is the maximum for Kazakhstan? The invitation letter and the project statement should match. So if you do need 5 months and the host is willing to have you there for 5 months, then state that. If you only need 4 months, then the invitation should state 4. So there shouldn't be any kind of discrepancy, because, again, 4 months and 5 months, there's a whole month of difference in terms of funding, and we need to know as we do the budgets for each of the countries and regions. So being as precise as possible would be better. So try and, if you want to split the difference and do 4.5 months, that's fine as well. Let's see. All right. Yes, so we have a question as to the competition this year. So we are recruiting for the awards for the 2021 and 2022 academic year. So that means the fall of 21 and the spring of 2022. And I know there's a lot of concern about COVID, and rightly so, but from my understanding, I haven't been told otherwise, everything is open and moving along for the awards in 21 and 22. If you feel, you know, if the award allows you to choose the start date for the spring of 2022 and you feel that would be a safer bet, you can certainly do that. You'll see, for example, in the award description, the grant dates and the parameters. So, for example, in the case of India, you can start as early as July 1st next year, as late as March 31st of 2022. So essentially nearly almost 2 years out. So again, keep that in mind as you prepare your project and also think about your leave and availability, that a lot of these awards could start in the spring of 2022. Okay. We have a question about sending a CV and a project proposal to give preliminary feedback. So we don't have capacity to do that, but I recommend you contacting past Fulbrighters, and you can find them in the Fulbright Scholar directory. So if I go back to our main page and I click on the Scholar directory here, you can actually search alumni from 2010 onwards, and if you click on the advanced filters, let's say you want to find somebody from India, rather who went to India, a grantee to India, you can see, you know, you can search by discipline or by host institution, etc. And if you click on the person's name, you'll get all of their information except the email. So the email you have to search, but you can see the title of their project, where they were based, the duration of their grant, and what they did. So this was a person who conducted research in Hyderabad. So this information is here, and a lot of our alumni have been very receptive to giving feedback to applicants, so feel free to reach out to more than one if you'd like some feedback. All right, lots of questions coming in. Are there fields that are best not to consider when applying? Well, certainly this is a program of the State Department, so we want to be sensitive to our diplomatic relations around the world. So just keep that in mind as you select topics and projects and themes. We certainly want everyone to have a successful Fulbright experience and contribute to the mission of the program, which is fostering mutual understanding. So thank you for that question. Okay. All right, so it looks like we still have a lot of students on the call. For those of you that just joined, if you are a student located outside of the U.S., you have a citizenship that is not a U.S. citizenship, please refer to the Fulbright Foreign Student Program. There is information at your U.S. Embassy as well as the Fulbright Commissions around the world, and you would be applying through either the U.S. Embassy or, in the case of Bangladesh, I believe, yes, it would be the U.S. Embassy there as well. So please take a look at that information. Okay, and yes, and the same is true for if you are based in India, please contact the Fulbright Commission in Delhi. That's the USIF office, USIEF, and they would have more information about deadlines, and I'm not sure if there's any age limit, so take a look at that. So, all right, let's see. Moving right along, we've just got about 9 minutes left. Let's take a look. Okay, so there's a question about travel to another country once you arrive in your host country. So I'm not quite sure what exactly you're asking, but what I would like to point out related to this is that for the South and Central Asia region, all of the awards offer a regional travel grant. And you'll see that here at the bottom of the first tab in the award description, there's the regional travel grant information as well as the mid-year conference. And these are both in-country perks, in-country benefits, so you would be able to apply for the regional travel grant once you are on your Fulbright in that particular country. So let's say you get a Fulbright award to Sri Lanka and you would like to visit Kazakhstan and be in a conference there, present or attend a conference, you would apply for the regional travel grant. And that would cover travel to and from the country as well as lodging. And that is, again, something that is offered once you are in country. The mid-year conference is something that's held in India every year, in either February or March. It's a different city in India, depending, you know, it kind of rotates amongst different cities. And if you are on your Fulbright grant during that time, you would be invited to that to meet all the other Fulbrighters in the South and Central Asia region. It's a few days. It's a conference where you get to meet student participants, visiting professors and faculty and former Fulbrighters. You'll have a chance to present your research, talk about your experiences. It's just a wonderful networking opportunity and a wonderful chance to learn about the other Fulbrighters and the whole educational exchange program that Fulbright is. So those are two wonderful benefits. Let's see, some more questions came in. Okay, so you have a question about contacting the Fulbright Commission in India to learn about their priorities. Certainly you can. I mean, there is, this is an all disciplines award with up to 42 grants. So that means up to 42 Fulbrighters will be selected to go to India. So they've purposely not mentioned any specialties because they're interested in receiving a wide variety of applications. But certainly you can reach out and check to see if your area of specialization is something they would be interested in and what potential hosts you could partner with. All right. I think we've gotten to everything. We've just got about 5 minutes left, so this is excellent. Again, this is being recorded and it will be archived. I'll show you where that will be archived. If you go to our landing page, cies.org, and you scroll down, you will see below the map, you'll see the webinar link, and if you click on the schedule, you'll see all of the ones that are upcoming. I encourage you all to attend. Tomorrow we have actually an alum from our new cohort of alumni ambassadors, and he was a grantee to India a few years ago. You'll also have a chance to meet the other new scholar alumni ambassadors. That's tomorrow from 4 to 5 Eastern Time. You can register here. And then we have other webinars. And I'd like to point out we have the application walkthrough webinar. We have two of them, one on August 26th, and this is where we will go page by page through the application. And then we have another one on the 9th of September. So keep in mind the deadline is September 15th. Alaska Standard Time, so for those of you on the East Coast, you can work until the wee hours of the night and submit your application. We certainly hope to receive it before the deadline, well before the deadline, so that you don't encounter any technical issues. But again, the deadline is September 15, Alaska Standard Time. And you can take a look here at the past webinars that we've held, and there's a whole bunch of them. I think we've done about 3 webinars every week. So take a look. We have a Spotlight on India webinar. We have a South and Central Asia webinar. Just scroll through up until February. You'll see all of the webinars that we've held in the past. And let's see, any other questions that came through? Oh, yes. So if you were interested in contacting the Fulbright Commission in India, you would look at the award description under the award requirements here. And the person, Priyanjana Ghosh, is listed here in that first paragraph. All right. Okay. All right. Well, that looks like we've gotten to all the questions. Thank you so much for joining us today for this webinar. Again, my name is Michelle Balorchi, and I recruit for the South and Central Asia region. Please contact me if you have any questions that come up after this webinar or you'd like some more information. Join an office hour. And again, we wish you all the best on your application going forward. And again, looking forward to receiving your application and hoping that you'll become a Fulbrighter soon. Thank you. Bye-bye.